calculations for about 15 years, part of the Network 14 of Texas. The hobbies, I would say any kind of sport. If I'm not playing it, I'll be there watching it. Disclosure, I would like to mention again the RPA. Medical director and our company has medical directorships for with multiple FMC dialysis facilities. With the local NKF chapter and previous national, the NKF.
Hi, I'm Alan Kleiger. I'm a nephrologist in New Haven, Connecticut. The chief medical officer and chief quality officer for the Hospital of St. Raphael's, one of the Yale teaching hospitals, and a clinical professor of medicine at Yale. My experience in quality goes back many years. I was on the steering committee for the original DOKI and then KDOKI. I served as chair and then member of the quality committees for the form of ESRD networks and then with the Renal Physicians Association as well. We had several projects over the last dozen years organizing nationally efforts to define quality initiatives and eventually quality measures such as we're measuring here. My only significant disclosure is that I have a investigator-directed research grant from Amgen, and I also am the immediate past president of the Renal Physicians Association.
Bob Provenzano, I'm a practicing clinical nephrologist from Detroit. I am a clinical professor of medicine at Wayne State in Detroit. Much like Alan, I am a past president of the RPA and currently serves as their counselor. I'm a past president of the Renal Network 11 of the Upper Midwest and of the National Kidney Foundation of Michigan. I currently serve as the chief strategy officer for DaVita and as a medical director in several DaVita facilities. Disclosures, I am on the board of directors of Vascalerc, which is a surveillance company for dialysis accesses. I do consulting work for Hemisphere, who produces the Hero catheters. And personal disclosures, my son is a nephrologist, practicing nephrologist, and I have six family members on dialysis. I think that's it. I've only been practicing 22 years as opposed to Velez.
I'm Andy Narva.
That's what they tell you. I am the director of the National Kidney Disease Education Program at NIDDK. Prior to that, I worked for the Indian Health Service and established the Kidney Disease Program for Indian Health, and I still continue to function as the Chief Clinical Consultant for Nephrology for Indian Health Service. My experience in qualities, I learned most about quality improvement as a member of the Medical Review Board of Network 15 for about 20 years. And as well, Indian Health Service is a fairly coherent and fairly large healthcare system that has a very excellent data system and has for many years and is very focused on using data to leverage out improved outcomes. And I was involved in that. And in my current job at NKDEP, we're very interested in promoting sort of systems change to improve care for people with CKD. And so we've collaborated closely with QIOs and a variety of other organizations, many of which are represented here. I have, it's illegal for me to have something to disclose, although I serve on a number of committees that develop guidelines, including JNC8, the KDOKI work group on kidney disease and diabetes, and I was a member of the ABM work group to develop a practice improvement model for nephrology. My hobbies are, I have a 2-year-old, as well as a 31, 29, and 25-year-old. Other than that, I'm a big game hunter, and I guess conduct for the National Symphony. I just made that up.
I'm Jerry Jackson. I'm a practicing nephrologist in Birmingham, Alabama, and I was a co-founder of our group over 33 years ago. We care for collectively just under 1,000 dialysis patients. I'm the medical director of two Fresenius clinics, and I average taking care personally of about 65 to 70 patients, many of whom I'm very close to and feel great compassion for what they have to go through. I'm also medical director of our outpatient vascular access center and work part-time there as an interventional nephrologist. And that is managed by a DaVita subsidiary called RMS Lifeline. I'm chairman of the Medical Review Board of Network 8, and we're very much engaged in external quality improvement. And that's Mississippi, Tennessee, Alabama. I'm very involved in internal quality improvement for my group after taking training at Institute for Healthcare Improvement. And as far, I'm the NQF voting member for the forum of ESRD networks. I'm on the RPA quality, safety, and accountability committee. And as far as hobbies, I like to read. I like photography, and we have four grandchildren between 8 months and 6 years that we're very involved in. That's it.
I'm very impressed to be in a room with so many interesting and diverse people. My name is Barbara Fivish. I'm the Division Chief of Pediatric Nephrology at Johns Hopkins. And additionally, I wear a totally different hat. I direct the Office of Women there and look at gender equity. I'm a professor of pediatrics and I'm a lifer at Hopkins. I've been there since 1978. There aren't that many lifers there, but I'm one of them. I've had a long interest in quality, and I tried to write it down to be complete. And I think I probably started back in the 90s. I was the pediatric representative to the ESRD-CPM project. I look around, Alan was involved in that. That was quite a while ago, and we had a very active committee at that time. I'm a member of the American Society of Pediatric Nephrology, and I am their representative to the AMA-PCPI, which is a developer of pediatric physician-level measures. And we're in the process, we recently developed two, and we're in the process of trying to develop a number more. I work closely as a representative of ASPN with KCP Kidney Care Partner. I'm on their KCQI committee as well as on their P committee as well as on their MIPA committee. So I do quite a bit of quality work with them. I'm also and have been for a long time, the clinical co-chair at the American Society of Pediatric Nephrology. I was a board member of the RPA, which was a wonderful experience. And now I continue on their quality committee and headed the pediatric committee looking at a shared decision in dialysis, initiation, and withdrawal. I'm a member of the International Pediatric Nephrology Association. I was a counselor for 6 years and now am working closely to look at their development agenda and where they need to go. I'm a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and I'm on their quality committee. Also work with the network. I helped our network develop the Five Diamond Safety Program, and I'm the pediatric representative to the network. On the National Kidney Foundation level, I'm on the KDOKI Grant Review Committee, and I'm on our local medical review board. I think that's most of my quality experience. I also have no disclosures at this time, or probably have never had disclosure, and I don't anticipate any disclosures. In terms of hobbies, I have two children who are really large children, 24 and 27. They are great. I'm waiting for grandchildren, jealous of everybody in the room who has them. I do love to travel, and through IFNA I've had a real opportunity to see lots of parts of the world. I also bike and exercise as much as I can, and probably one surprising thing about me is I'm addicted to Mahjong, which is a tile game, and I try and play that at least once a week. So just sharing with everybody. And lastly, I'm a very, very big sports fan and excited about the Ravens playing this Saturday. That's all I have.
Rick Caskill, I'm Barbara's friend. I too am honored to be in the room and to be one of the two pediatric nephrologists on the panel with Barbara. So I'm vice chairman and director of the pediatric nephrology program at Einstein and Montefiore in the dialysis unit and an NIH training program. I've served multiple capacities with the American Society of Pediatric Nephrology and the International Pediatric Nephrology, former president of ASPN. In terms of quality issues, I've worked with Kay Donkey on the growth guidelines. I've been with Andy as a pediatric representative on the NKDEP initiative. I was on the medical advisory board of IPRO in New York. I've served, one of my most enjoying services was as an FDA cardiovascular and renal advisory committee, especially when they were reviewing anemia. So I could go on, but I think with representing pediatric nephrology along with Barbara in the interest of children is an honor. Thank you. I have no disclosures except my wife, 4 children, 2 grandchildren, and I like things outside, and I sail, including in the winter.
I'm Joe Nally, and I think I'm smarter than sailing in the winter. I am impressed. I am a nephrologist at the Cleveland Clinic, where I'm a clinical professor of medicine. I'm also the director of the Center for CKD. In terms of other interests related to quality, I joined the medical advisory board for Kay Donkey 2002 through the National Kidney Foundation, went through that process, sat on a few writing committees, and I'm also currently a vice chair for Kay Donkey Public Policy. At home, I am a PI on our new CKD registry, which actually will be published this week, I hope, in CJSON. And outside hobbies, golfer, racquetball, sports guy, but importantly, I have 2 granddaughters, 3.5 and 1.5. Unfortunately, they live in Philadelphia, closer to Jeffrey than me, but he has visitation rights on weekends. Thank you.
I'm Sue Barnes. I'm Sue Barnes with Kaiser Permanente's National Office supporting infection prevention and control throughout our program, and I'm representing APIC, which is the Association for Prevention of Infections. And my experience in hemodialysis is really restricted to I facilitated the development of the APIC guideline on prevention of infections in hemodialysis, and I worked with a lot of your colleagues and I learned so much, and mostly I learned what a complex discipline this is, so I'm really excited to be part of this. My disclosures are that I'm a member of the board of directors of national, or it's actually international APIC now. I was a TAP member for the NQF patient safety measure development focused on healthcare associated infections last year. I am Kaiser Permanente employee, and MedMind, which was a listed on the list of organizations, which is a automated infection surveillance software program. 2 of our Kaiser facilities have implemented that, and I've been consequently involved in implementing that in a number of meetings relative to it. And EPIC is our Kaiser's form of electronic medical record. Oh, hobby is I still play soccer. I think I have about 1.5 years left in my old Kaiser, in my old geezer bones. Thank you.
I was so excited about my
granddaughters that I forgot about my disclosures. I'm a medical director for Fresenius Unit, and I also have the development and infrastructure support of the registry from an unrestricted grantor department from Amgen. Thank you.
I'm Jeff Burns. I'm a nephrologist in Philadelphia. I've been practicing nephrology for 20-some-odd years. I spent my formative years as learning from Alan Kleiger, who was an attending of mine when I was a fellow. I'm a professor of medicine and pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania, associate dean for graduate medical education, and run our renal fellowship program. My principal disclosures are that I served until about 6 or 9 months ago on a data safety monitoring board for a clinical trial run by Affimax, which is now closed. I currently serve as an executive committee member on an advisory capacity to Amgen for a clinical trial that they are developing with the FDA that has not been launched. I'm on the advisory board for Litholink, which is developing or has developed a CKD lab testing organization, and they are owned by LabCorp. I currently serve as the vice chair for guidelines and commentaries for National Kidney Foundation, KDOKI. I was on the original KDOKI and then KDOKI anemia work group, and currently serve on the KDIGO anemia work group. Although I'm not a medical director and actually don't see dialysis patients right now, the university's dialysis facilities are owned by DaVita. My hobby is that I run.
Ellen, good morning.
Paul,
yes, sir. And my newest friend, Ann, told me how not to fail. So I apologize for being late, but I did do a red eye last night from the West Coast or the Left Coast, but I'm glad I'm here. Jesse Pavlinak, I work at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, Oregon, as the Director of Clinical Nutrition Services and a renal dietitian. Have worked in ESRD, transplant, pediatric hemodialysis before our university sold their dialysis unit for over 30 years. Immediate past president of the American Dietetic Association, has just recently worked on the end-stage, the chronic kidney disease non-dialysis practice guidelines for that organization, and involved in National Kidney Foundation Council on Renal Nutrition. Hobbies. Well, my husband and I are charter members of the One More Time Around Again marching band in Portland, Oregon. We're an adult marching band. We've been doing it for 25 years, and I suppose that's our hobby. I don't think I have any disclosures, and thank you very much.
Are there any committee members on the phone? Okay. All right. Do any of you have any questions of each other or anything you would like to discuss regarding the disclosures? Okay, I'll take that as a no. Thank you all for participating. You all did very well. Excellent disclosures, and have a good meeting.
Okay, thank you, Ann. Public members and submitters of metrics will be able to introduce themselves briefly when they do their presentation. They don't need to follow this format. Dinner reservations, we're supposed to let Lauren know by during our morning break. If you'd like to join us for dinner tonight at this Fire and Sage up the street a little bit.
Okay, it's right here.
Oh, it's right here in this building. Okay. Hey, we don't have to go out in the snow. And just one other thing, for the chair's convenience, we'd like to be on a first name basis with the committee. We may call you by your first name. We may call you by your last name. We may say, hey, you, but please respond in a kindly manner. Thank you. If that's all right, I'd just like to have your permission to use first names. If anybody isn't comfortable, let me know. Okay, I'll turn it over to Karen and Lauren now to give us a project introduction and overview.
Well, we will try to keep the overview as brief as we possibly can. I know we have a full agenda before us today, but we just wanted to provide a really brief, high-level summary of the project for those that are new to the committee, as well as our developers that are here in person and on the phone. So with that, my computer is going here. There we go. So, of course, we are here for the committee to recommend endorsement for additional measures on ESRD care. And as you all know, there are currently 25 endorsed measures that were endorsed back in 2008. And again, this project is limited to that of ESRD care only and does not encompass CKD. However, there is an endorsement maintenance project that will begin in a couple of months here where we will look at all things renal, including ESRD as well as CKD. And again, the committee is asked to act as a proxy for our multi-stakeholder membership here and work with us to achieve the goals of evaluating the candidate standards against our evaluation criteria and ultimately make recommendations for endorsement, as well as respond to comments received on your recommendations. Again, this is just our consensus development process, or our CDP as we like to refer to it, and we are about halfway through. After we adjourn tomorrow, we will immediately begin the process of compiling all of your recommendations and beginning a draft report, in which you all will have a hand in creating the draft report, as well as responding to the comments received in the report. And then we will move on to voting and ultimately to the CSAC decision and to the board and an appeals process if necessary. And again, this is just a visual schematic of our CDP. Again, with the next hurdle being creating the draft report and posting that for member and public comment. Our objectives for today and tomorrow, again, to evaluate the measures for recommendation for endorsement. Tomorrow afternoon, I believe it is, we will move into reviewing related and competing measures to facilitate harmonization, as well as measures for best in class, and identify any remaining gaps in performance for ESRD care. Just a quick breakdown of the measures. As I'm sure you all know, there are 32 with 7 subtopics, and the bulk of those being in anemia, fluid weight, and infection. I'm going to turn it over to Karen briefly to go over our measure evaluation criteria, and then I will come back again to go over the format for the evaluation process today, as well as our voting procedures.
Okay. First of all, I want to compliment this committee. You were just stellar in reviewing the measures as we asked you to and entering your evaluations online. And so I'm going to just quickly go through our evaluation criteria and then see if there are any questions or issues that you identified in terms of understanding the criteria as you were working through the measures so that we can address those before we get into the discussion of the measures. We have certain conditions before we will even consider measures. I won't go through those today because we can staff review these before we send the measures on to you. We have 4 major criteria, and we look at these in a hierarchy. First, we look at importance to measure and report. We really want to endorse performance measures for those aspects of care with the greatest potential of driving improvements. Next is scientific acceptability of the measure properties. This has to do with making reliable and ultimately valid conclusions about the quality of care based on the scores from the measures. We want the measures to be usable so that people can use them regarding decisions related to selection and improvement. And then finally, feasible. Ideally, we want measures that have the least burden in terms of data collection and reporting. And if we have competing measures and QF prefers to endorse one measure, the best way to measure, and we will talk more about that, as Lauren said, tomorrow. So we have the 4 major criteria. As you know, each of those criteria have sub-criteria, and that's what you look at to determine if a measure actually meets our criteria. We think that those sub-criteria parallel best practices for measure development. For example, if you begin with identifying what is important to measure and later what is feasible. Most criteria involve a matter of degree rather than an all-or-nothing determination. However, importance to measure and report is a threshold criterion where we ask you to identify either yes or no that it has been met. importance to measure and report. Again, the focus here is on measuring those aspects of care that are most likely to really drive improvements in the quality of care and achievement of desired outcomes. And there's three components to this. We want to really endorse measures that have a high impact, and this can be that it affects a large volume of patients. It could be high consequences of poor quality. It could be high resource use. So ESRD care fits a lot of those areas of high impact. Gap in performance. Here we're looking at wanting to endorse measures that where there's variation in quality across providers, or that there's overall poor quality. So again, we want to endorse measures where we're actually it's going to help drive improvements. And the third aspect of this is that there's evidence that supports the measure focus. So we really want to endorse those, especially when we're talking about structures and processes, those things where there is strong evidence that they lead to the desired outcomes. I'll just make a couple notes here. In the evaluation criteria, and I think you have a pamphlet that was distributed just for your reference today, we have a footnote 14, and that is that all things being equal, NQF would prefer to endorse measures of aspects of care that are most proximal to the desired outcomes. So you all know that in your practice, there's many steps in a process. We start with assessment, then diagnosis, then we identify the treatment options, select a treatment, administer the treatment. Usually, the evidence is for that treatment to the desired outcome. So one of the things that we'll ask you to think about as we're looking at importance on measures that are more distal to that desired outcome is that something that we really should invest resources into performance measurement when there are other things that are more proximal to the desired outcome that perhaps we would get more bang for our buck. The other thing that I think we try to emphasize here is that there are many things that are important to delivering care that doesn't necessarily always translate that we want a performance measure for every single thing that it's important for to happen in clinical care practices. We'd have thousands and thousands of measures if we went down that road. So we'll ask you to be thinking about that as we talk about importance to measure and report. Scientific acceptability of measure properties. What this really boils down to is reliability and validity of the measures as they are specified. So importance to measure and report is more at the concept level of what you're intending to measure. Reliability and validity really is related to the measure as it's specified. So you can have a good idea to measure something for quality, but the way the measure's constructed really doesn't achieve that because you end up with unreliable or invalid results. So we'll certainly be addressing this as we go through. For outcome measures, risk adjustment is a big component of looking at whether you have that you can make valid conclusions about quality from a particular measure. Usability, I think this is something that all of you will have experience with in terms of thinking about these measures, and is this, if you have the information on this measure for a particular facility, if you're a consumer or a payer, will that help you make a determination of whether you'd want to receive care there, contract with that facility for care? If you're a provider or a facility, is that information that will help you look at your own care and make improvements? So that's what we're really looking for under usability. And lastly, feasibility. Certainly, data that is electronically collected. Ultimately, we're moving toward really wanting to have measures that are based in electronic health records so that quality measurement can be a byproduct of care and the documentation that you're already doing. But obviously that's not a widespread reality at this point in time. But again, an assessment of how feasible is it to collect the data that's needed for the particular performance measure that's proposed. So as Peter mentioned earlier, we really will try to get you to look at these measures individually first, even though you know that there are other measures competing. We really want to make sure that each measure is reviewed and evaluated against the criteria. And then tomorrow we'll really look at comparison of measures to see if there are issues with measure harmonization of specifications or if we have multiple measures on the same topics that we'll start addressing. Is there one that's really superior to the others, and what would reason that we would need multiple measures if we can't make that determination? Okay, I'll let Lauren pick up there. Yes, go ahead.
Just to clarify, our role here is to evaluate the measures as written. There's no opportunity or room for editing or revising, coming up with a slightly tweaked measure.
Well, I'll modify that. You know, pretty much we have to deal with the measures as they have been provided to us. There is some room for suggestions to the measure developers. You know, it's kind of a fine line. If you are suggesting lots of changes, it actually becomes a new measure, and we're crossing the line into measure development versus tweaking a measure. So, you know, certainly bring those issues up, and we'll help navigate that. So there are some potential opportunities.
The other measures that had previously been endorsed by NQF, and they will be looked at again by NQF. But at this point, we won't be discussing those measures or potentials for harmonization backwards to those measures.
Yes, actually we will. And tomorrow what we'll do is, it's on your flash drive actually, we've put together some comparison tables so that if we have a measure from the last project that is similar to or related, we'll look at those side by side and see if there are any harmonization or whether it should be one measure, those kinds of issues. But we will have an opportunity to look at those in relation to the new measures.
Thank you.
Question as a new member, because this has been a very daunting task looking at all this. But when you use those criteria and assume that most questions are important, then you get down to the specifics, say, of scientific acceptability, whereby there is information presented, but when other groups have looked at it, they might have said, since, let's use bone mineral as an example. There is some evidence here, but it's all level two. And there are committee suggestions out there that, you know, that needs more discussion or investigation. So what exactly would the criteria be in that circumstance when there's level two evidence? And then another area where there's also an important question, but maybe the feasibility, the methodology of either using data that's a couple years old from Medicare claims forms and then transitioning to a crown web. In other words, the methodology is not in place. What is the approach to those things where you don't know what crown web has to offer about hospitalization and infections down the road?
Let me talk about the first question about the evidence. And just to clarify, we look at the evidence, the clinical evidence for whatever you're suggesting to be measured under importance to measure and report. So we really want a strong clinical evidence foundation, because otherwise, why do we want to, if we don't know that something really improves patient outcomes, do we want to invest time and effort into measuring it. And then under scientific acceptability of measure properties, that's where we look at the reliability and validity of the specific measure that's being provided. So all of these criteria, as I mentioned, you know, it's not a black and white thing, and that's why we assemble this group of experts with different perspectives and different areas of expertise to help us go through this, because there are trade-offs at times. You know, there are different ways of looking at it, and so there's not one answer usually, and that's why we need your collective knowledge to kind of wade through this. In terms of measures that are untested, and we'll have Helen make some comments here in a moment too, generally we're trying to get away from endorsing untested measures, and we'll talk about this a little bit more. So the issue with moving into a new data platform with Crown Web, they may have done some pilot testing, and that's perfectly acceptable for us to have pilot testing results on a small sample. If there's absolutely no testing, I think that's something we'll have to discuss. Sometimes when moving to a different data platform, they're really going to use exactly the same specifications that they did for their prior data collection. So it'll vary depending on the particular measure. So I'll stop there and see if that has answered at least some of your questions.
Yes, thank you. And I suspect we'll get into this, that dig a little deeper with the H measure.
Karen, among the criteria that you described, you did not include unintended consequences. And in the field of measure development, it's become very clear that unintended consequences have a major negative effect on approved or endorsed measures. Might you say something about that to us?
Right. I actually skipped over that. It is one of the sub-criteria under feasibility. If, you know, we ask the measure developer to discuss, and it's something we ask you then to look at, is are there particular issues with potential for inaccuracies, errors, and unintended consequences? So it is certainly something that you can bring up and discuss. We often have difficulty in this area because it's more theoretical than actual having data to support that. So, but it's certainly an issue that can be discussed and deliberated over as you review the measures. Peter.
Karen, are you going to discuss now or fill us in a bit on the time-limited issue? You know, I think looking at many of the metrics we have before us, whether they were identified as only eligible for time-limited or not, and whether we can recommend time limit, how does all that play out?
That really is a, we make that determination of which measures are eligible, only eligible for time limited endorsement based on whether there has been any testing. So we do sometimes get into the discussion with committees that, you know, even though the measure has been tested, they have some questions and they would feel more comfortable recommending it for time-limited endorsement, but we really have only specific requirements, and that is that there's been no testing. So if the measure has been tested and you don't think the testing results indicate that it's really going to result in reliable and valid measurement, then you really need to think about not recommending it.
Oh, and if the committee does recommend a time-limited approval, does the committee then get back together in a year and review the data to say, yes, okay, now we can go ahead to a three-year approval? Is CSAC does that?
Yes. Measure developers have to submit the testing results within 12 months of the endorsement, and that does go back to the consensus. Yes.
We knew this would come up, as it always does. So we are definitely at a point, I think, in the whole measurement enterprise where there's both an appetite for new measures as fast as possible, And at the same time, high stakes measurement and lots of concerns about untested measures. So we're kind of really in that middle vortex, I think, which makes this a bit difficult. We discussed this in great detail with the board of directors last year. We made a determination, and this project is actually under the new guidance. So the new guidance from the board is that we will only accept time-limited measures if all three of the following criteria are met. The first is that there's a clear gap in the portfolio. And there are some areas, like perhaps some of the ESRD infection measures, where we don't actually have any measures like that in the portfolio. So that's the first requirement. The second is that there is a time-sensitive legislative mandate. Now, we know there are payment rules for ESRD, but we also need to understand from the developers and CMS when, in fact, there is an opportunity to allow the 6 months for testing and really revisit it when the measure has been tested. And that is the second one. The third is that the measures can't be what we call complex. They can't have a risk adjustment methodology attached to them. They can't be composites, things that really, they're not sort of the basic process measures. It's hard to envision anybody wanting to use a complex measure that's not been tested. So all three of those are, in fact, required for a time-limited measure to move forward. This is one of the first projects that's initiated since that board policy went into effect. So the final piece of that is it used to be we would say time-limited testing that measures had to come back within 12 to 24 months. Clearly, people think that's too long. They now must come back within 12 months, and the developers have to present to us a plan that demonstrates to the committee that you really think they're capable, that they have the resources and the plan to actually test the measures within that time period. So clearly, this is a significant narrowing of this funnel, I suspect, within X period of time, within a couple of years. I think time-limited measures will probably go away. But I think because of the need to continually add measures for many areas for which there aren't measures, the board left it in place for now. I don't know how long that will persist.
When we get to review of the measures that are recommended for time-limited, can we just write those three criteria somewhere?
Yes, so absolutely. We'd be happy to do that. Yep.
to go back to our December 2nd conference call, there was a lot of consensus among this group that while looking at all the measures that are proposed at the clinical profile of the patient, that it was important to bring it back to the patient and look at other measures that are very significant in the quality of care, but that we really haven't yet identified or talked about or certainly tested. Is there an opportunity during this two-day meeting to look at those kinds of things?
Yes, and one of the things that we put on your flash drive is kind of expanded that table that we started with and added some of the discussion, and we'll go back to that tomorrow to get your feedback on that, identify where there are measurement gaps, because we do want this committee to make those recommendations. Hopefully measure developers will take that to heart and start working on those kinds of measures. Okay.
I just wanted to follow up on Alan's comment about the unintended consequences, and especially since there are patients here, we want to serve the patients as best as we possibly can. I just want to make the point that there may be measures here that we believe clinically we should do, that we feel strongly they may have an impact, that they're important to patient care, that they should potentially be part of quality improvement processes. But because this is potentially incentive-based, there'll be a financial incentive to these measures. These measures will have a huge impact on care. I just want to be very careful about what we do here. And I wanted to wonder if you had any comments about that, but really the measures that have the highest quality evidence that we really feel confident in, because we will focus physician and dialysis facility behavior toward these measures, which could potentially take their behavior away from other activities that are important. And there also may be unintended consequences of some of these measures that we don't even understand. So I just wanted to make that point, and I want to serve the patients and the dialysis community as best as we possibly can here today.
Yeah, just a couple comments, and I think that's a really important point, and it's something that's going to continue to come up. I think the difficulty is for a lot of the measures you're looking at that they have been tested, pilot tested, but not in use. It's oftentimes difficult to know what the unintended consequences will be. So we actually put emphasis on it at the initial endorsement, but in fact it's a much larger consideration for measures when they're up for maintenance. We also have what's called ad hoc maintenance, so that, for example, if there's an unintended consequence identified in the community, it can be brought to NQF at any time, and we'll convene an ad hoc panel to look at it. But again, oftentimes it's sort of theoretical. We just had a discussion yesterday on our call about a perceived unintended consequence. The immediate question was, well, what's the level? How many people would this affect? And again, it's often very difficult to know for a measure that's not in use. The other sort of big picture issue I want to raise, and I know Karen did earlier as well, is harmonization. We have now got over 600 measures in the NQF portfolio. A good number of them are there because they, in fact, cover lots of different clinical areas, settings of care, et cetera. We also have a lot of, I think as our harmonization committee called it, unintentional disharmony, where measures are just sort of put, I love that term, where measures are put forward without consideration of how the measures relate to other settings of care, how they relate to patients. Patients are patients, as all of this little row knows, patients flow through different settings of care. It's not always a single setting of care or a single provider who takes care of them. And so we really need your help here. We would want you to both focus within the portfolio of measures that are being presented in ESRD. But in some of the instances, and I'm glad Sue's here on the infection side, there are measures, we've already got HAI-related measures that are broader than dialysis. And I think one question we'd really like you to think about is how much can you use, for example, at least make sure we harmonize with the existing measures so we don't avoid people having different requirements if it's a bloodstream infection in a hospital versus identification of a bloodstream infection in a dialysis facility. So we really will need your help here. And as much as possible, if measures are not harmonious, if there are differences, you've got to be able to indicate there's a justification for that lack of harmony. And that was a really important finding out of the committee that Karen just led for us on harmonization. As much as possible, we want measures that are harmonized across settings and providers and patient groups. But if they're not harmonized, we've got to have a justification saying the lack of harmony is justified because of it's really important. This is an important strategy. It'll drive improvement, et cetera. So just really thanking you in advance for this. And again, if you can identify the unintended consequences for us, it would be great for us to try to ask the developers to actually do some analyses for you to be more quantitative about it. But it's, something we recognize we won't always have the capacity to do in advance.
On Lisa's point was, if we recommend something for time-limited testing, would that be part of the QIP and incentive-based?
Well, NQF endorses measures, and then other people use them. But once it's endorsed, even if it's time-limited endorsement, it could be used by those that are required to use and endorse measures.
And just important to remember that, really, you would only put through a measure for time-limited endorsement if it otherwise meets all of the NQF criteria. You think it's completely fine. You just don't have pilot testing data yet. So you really have to feel very comfortable that that measure is ready to move into prime time.
So if we really have methodologic recommendations, we should not do a time-limited endorsement. Methodologic changes. If we want them to change something and do a testing, it should not be endorsed. It should only be if it's perfect. We think it's perfect. We just don't have the proof it's perfect.
You think it meets the overall criteria. Perfect is a...
Yeah.
I live in a world of gray. I don't know what perfect is, but I think it's got to meet the other criteria otherwise, but it does not yet have testing data.
On the other hand, measures that haven't yet been tested, there's more room potentially to make some recommendations for the measurement because, it's more difficult for a measure that's already been tested to say, oh, now we want you to change it this way, because then at what point does the testing become invalid based on the changes? So it's a little difficult there.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Just to understand this, there's room for time-limited measures, although we're not really looking for those, but there are opportunities for those measures that have not been previously tested. When there's a need, when it's evaluated that, but I just want to understand one more time. Can measures that are previously untested be given full endorsement, or will they have to be given time limited? I mean, is there a circumstance with which, without previous testing, I understand we don't want measures that are time limited, but we know there may be circumstances when that may happen. Does that mean that time-limited measure, that untested measures will never get endorsement without first getting time-limited endorsement? That is correct. So any measure that we consider that's not been previously tested but is important could potentially get time-limited but will never get unlimited endorsement.
And just to clarify, NQF does not have unlimited endorsement. Endorsement is for 3 years. And then all the measures are reviewed again. And that's, we've moved into a new process, which we call endorsement maintenance cycles by topic. And that's what the next phase of this project is really going to be, the renal endorsement maintenance. So we'll be looking at all of those measures that were previously endorsed as well as new measures. So, you know, just like everything else, there are advances in measurement, there are changes in clinical practice, et cetera, and so measures need to be updated as well and make sure that they still meet our criteria. A measure that was endorsed, you know, 3 years ago may no longer be important for us to be endorsing again.
Sorry, one last question. And so if we don't approve something and say it needs whatever changes, when is that then the next opportunity for the measure submitter to resubmit for consideration?
That's a possibility. We have a couple things. If the committee really feels that they can't recommend a measure for endorsement unless some change is made, again, it will depend on what that change is. It could be something that could be accommodated within this project. After this meeting, if there are any of those kinds of things, we will go back to the measure developers, have a discussion with them about what your recommendation is, see if that can be accommodated or not. They will respond to the committee, and then you will decide where to go from there.
Okay, it's time for us to...
Warren has a couple of...
Before we actually dive into the measures, just a couple of logistics. As you all notice on the agenda, there is a designated place for member and public comment, and that will actually begin... The first one will be... I know we're a little bit behind, but we'll have one in the morning, and again one this afternoon, and then twice again on tomorrow. The measure developers will do a brief introduction of their measures starting here shortly, and they are available to you for questions or clarifications throughout the day as you discuss the measures. And then we will take each measure discussed and then vote on them separately. As you all know, everyone had their assigned measures, in which I'm sure you're well versed in by now. One committee member will begin a discussion by just providing the group with a summary from the evaluations that you provided in the Excel file. And each from then, the full committee will discuss the measures. We will vote, and we will save related and competing measures until tomorrow. And speaking of voting, does everyone have a little remote control here? If we can pass one to Jesse and Lisa. One more round to Andrew, please. So the measure number and title will be displayed on the second screen here, and you will see a question for each of the major criteria as well as the sub-criteria. And so what you do is you enter your response on the remote control here, and it's either be 1 through 4, and you'll enter 1 and then send to indicate your response. So, for example, measure number 1418, frequency of adequacy measurement. Does a measure meet NQF criteria for importance? 1, yes. 2, no. So we hit 1, then send, or 2, then send. The caveat here is that once you hit send, you cannot change your response. So if you would like to change your response before you hit send, it's 1, then the exclamation point here, the caution symbol, and then your change response. So if you want to change your answer from 1 to 2, it's 1, caution symbol 2, and then send, and et cetera. So once we have the question up and we've discussed the measure until we're blue in the face, we will then be ready to vote, and you'll have 60 seconds. There will be a timer in the lower right-hand corner there, and then the results will be displayed. We'll have the total number of votes, and the co-chairs will kind of summarize the votes and... We'll move from there. So,
all right. Okay.
All right. It's time to meet the public and NQF members who are attending. First by phone. Who's on the phone with us?
invite you to introduce yourself and make any comments you'd like to. Do we have somebody on the phone before? The phone line's open, but apparently there's nobody on right now.
Actually, I'm on. This is Tom Dudley from CMS.
Yes.
And this is Sherry Ling from CMS.
This is Jess Perry from the group from Arbor Research Collaborative for Health and the University of Michigan.
This is Sylvia Ramirez from the Arbor Research Collaborative for Health.
Okay, those of you who are not, who are attending and not as measure developers on the phone, do you have any comments for us?
And this is the opportunity. They can press star one if they have a question or comment at this time.
So it's a negative.
Could you repeat that again? Who just spoke?
This is the operator. If a person on the phone has a question or comment, they can press star one.
Right. And this is for NQF member and public comment. We'll go to the measure developers and stewards in a minute. In short.
After the break.
After the break, sorry.
We do have Dale Singer that has a question.
Operator, we're having trouble understanding you. Could you say that again?
Dale Singer is on the line.
Okay.
I just wanted to say hello. I'm Dale Singer with the Renal Physicians Association.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other comments from those on the telephone? Okay, and in person, we have several people in the back. Can you stand up and identify yourself and make any comments you'd like to? Please use a microphone and
Partners is the National Coalition of Patient Advocates, healthcare professionals and providers, and suppliers working together to improve care for patients with chronic kidney disease and end-stage renal disease. KCP appreciates this opportunity to comment on the measures that we have referred to during the meeting this morning. I'd like to preface my remarks about specific measures by noting that as KCP reviewed the detailed specifications over the past 2 months, we felt that it was important to do so in the regulatory context faced by the ESRD committee. Specifically, Medicare ESRD program is unique in that it is the federal government's only true pay-for-performance program. Thus, our review of the measures focused on their appropriateness for public reporting, but also for payment. We also noted that the vast majority of the measures had not been tested for reliability and validity, and so also expressed our concern in that regard. So starting first with the pediatric measures, KCP has no objections to any of the 8 proposed pediatric consensus standards. We support all 8 measures for use in public reporting and for payment purposes. We also wanted to state that given the dearth of existing pediatric ESRD measures, KCP notes that it's important to begin building the portfolio across additional measurement topics for pediatrics. Next, turning to adult anemia management measures, KCP only supports these measures for public reporting if the specifications are modified. We don't support any of the measures for payment purposes. We'd also like to recommend a few modifications to the management measures. First, we feel the requirement for a simultaneous ferritin and TSAT collection date should be removed from both the numerator and denominator in all 3 of the measures. There are several reasonable scenarios where simultaneous values might not be recorded that are outside the facility's realm of control, for example, lab errors and so on. In these instances, the facility would be unfairly penalized. KCP is also concerned about the potential for unintended consequences, specifically increased costs with this requirement. Facilities might end up having to repeat testing to get the required simultaneous values. KCP instead believes that the test should be required within the same reporting month rather than on the same day. Next, for measure 1428, use of iron therapy when indicated, KCP believes that the exclusion should be granted from patients with hemoglobin greater than 12 to patients with hemoglobin greater than 10. KCP is concerned that there are clinically stable patients with hemoglobin values between 10 and 12. For whom IV iron could do nothing to improve their care, their clinical status, or their outcomes. and we believe that excluding patients with hemoglobin values between 10 and 12 would resolve this issue. And finally, KCP recommends that an exclusion be added to measure 1429, avoidance of iron therapy and iron overload. Specifically, as many nephrologists typically obtain a TSAT value and then act on it 1 to 2 months later, requiring avoidance of iron for 3 months is inappropriate and absence of current practice. We believe this concern should be alleviated by adding exclusion for patients in whom confirmatory or follow-up TSAT are less than 50%. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, come on up and use the microphone.
Thank you. I'm Robin Nishimi, representing KCP today. And as an NQF member, we appreciate the opportunity to comment on this project. As Lisa has just noted, KCP's review of the proposed consensus standards was done with an eye for their final release for public reporting only or public reporting and payment. So with that in mind, I'd like to provide KCP's comments now on some measures that you're not going to review until the afternoon, but since there's no public comment period just before that, we're going to comment now. For the fluid weight management measures, KCP opposes number 1438, periodic assessment of post-dialysis weight by nephrologists, since we do not think it is appropriate to evaluate at the facility level because it's a clinician responsibility. We also oppose all the other proposed fluid weight management measures in this area. For the three mineral and bone measures, KCP supports these three measures for public reporting and payment and has no recommended modifications to the specification.
Okay, thank you. Any other public or NQF members here to comment, would like to comment? Okay, then I think we've reached break time. We'll take 10 minutes. That will get us back in our chairs about shortly after the half hour, and we'll move on from there. Okay. Andrew?
If you want to connect to the Internet, I've been to other meetings in this hotel. You can do it, I think, upstairs.
Right. Yeah, we have not made arrangements for internet connectability here, which may be a good thing. I don't know. Maybe you don't want to look at your email for a while. Okay, we're on break for 10 minutes.
I'm reading.
Advanced technology. Yeah, don't let anybody know.
But I summarized it from.
Are you doing pay for it? Because I had to
say something.
Get on the web.
Name of the measure, description of the measure. I made sure I evaluated the measure. You're just representing it back. Not everybody read every comment.
Right.
And then you're supposed to comment on if anybody made any specific comments that you feel important to mention. Or I don't know, the measures you're presenting, were they voted? Were there any no's? Right. So that's what I don't know. My world, yes. So it was easy for me to say, oh, yes.
Okay.
You know, because that's right. All right, so we're going to go to dinner with the
commission.
Okay. Oh, did you see the visitor's email?
I suppose so.
So he has an MOU anyway.
Yes. No, I had forgotten that they signed it. They signed it.
Okay, so it's done. Did you see what I sent?
Yeah, I think it's great. It'd be very nice. Here's the story from the studio. I had a talking about this Congress about some financial issues.
Okay.
So when I told him that you were going to be sending him the email, it came up right in the conversation. And I said that you did a great job with them. This is a great partnership. It's a win-win for us. They want to have a...
It's like she's going
to
do the grant writing.
Right, and I said...
We can look at the grant writing for content.
I said, the only thing it's going to do is cost us a little bit of money with this conference. So his suggestion on the conference was, father, I'm going to go.
I'm not going.
Wait, I got on the website this weekend. Yes.
You want to go?
I'm not going.
Okay, wait a minute. So wait, we have to.
In Moshi, Tanzania.
Yeah, but if you look where Tanzania is, it borders Sudan. Okay, and there's a threat. We got in the State Department. There's a warning for travelers because they opened fire on a bus in Kenya. Kenya's to the north, within a couple of hundred kilometers from the mean. Next, and Sudan's in the south. There are two people that can represent Italy at this meeting at this late date. One is Malcolm Lewis in the UK, who was there with me when I went to Abuja. He was there with his girlfriend. She's in the ICU. Trish, who's great. They would probably love to go.
They'd love it.
Okay, and or he said, you know Martin Blitzer, who's up at Montreal Children's, who apparently has lived in Africa and done some work. So we can make two recommendations to these people. He'll pay.
Okay.
He said he'll pay.
It looks like only one
speaker. Then it should be Martin Blitzer.
Right, but we'll look at the program later.
And then we can email him. As he sort of said, no, there's more of him. Right,
oh, I don't want to.
No,
I don't want to go to Japan. Are we going to Japan?
No, I don't think so. That's regional secretary. That's regional secretary.
No, but you know, it's Israel Douglas at the last minute. He's coming on to him.
No, I don't think. I think we should worry about Brazil.
Brazil?
In October. But this would work nice with our. This would be good.
Yeah, no, I think I was really happy with it. I think
you need your purse when you were?
Yeah, I was going to leave it on the floor so I could clean up my mess here. Hey, Robin, how are you? It's good to see you. I'm like, so like. So if they approve the pediatric measures, they can only get time when the angels are. They're going to have to be tested. Oh, and your meds will be responsible.
Because they're the main people.
Okay, but I was going to say, God, because there's nobody representing. So is CMS supposed to be here representing the
measures? Well,
Arbor.
So,
Bob will.
Okay,
so they didn't talk. Why didn't they talk?
Because they talked when the measures came.
So the only people that talk now were by KCP, which is not a measure development at this time.
Yeah, we will be a measure developer during the endorsement maintenance because we have the KCP land measures.
But so let me get back to that. So she said those are coming up again. Those were approved in 2008. They were tested. That was all the work of the cases, right?
Right.
And then
some people
did not test it.
Sort of okay, but not really.
Our pace for the testing. So now when that comes up, those are your measures. And we don't know when that's going to be yet.
Sometime this year, in the first half of this year.
So we don't really know what's going to happen. That's interesting because I think some of the PX measures could be harmonized backwards to some of the adult measures that exist in the 08 test.
Well, but, and so when that
because we don't have any pediatric measures
when that conversation comes up during the harmonization tomorrow, that's when.
All right, so that's what I'm saying. So we could see whether adult measures like that are similar to that. Should we do that, or should we just let CMS test it?
I would let it go. Truthfully, I would just let CMS
do that if they feel like it, because really the reality is
right now
we don't know how it's going to test out.
Right.
Right. Okay. No, I think it went okay. I mean, nothing's happened so far. That'll be interesting. Lisa looks totally different. It's funny. She cut her hair and she went a little darker. I think, did she?
Did she go darker? She definitely cut her hair. Yeah.
No, you know, it's so funny because people don't recognize me. And my mom's like, how can you not recognize me? I look the same. I have different hair. So I'm looking at her. I'm like, oh, my God, it's Lisa. It looks so different. You know what I mean? It really does make a difference sometimes. But this will be fun. I'll get it.
These voting things are cool. That's new.
You know, I didn't, you know, I could try to think, do I have to sync this voting thing into my, I have to clean up after myself after sitting at a table. Do I have to sync it in there? It's like, no, it's just
it's free. It's wireless.
That's something. Well, that's exciting, yeah.
I'm going to go thank Myra because she was on a peak now.
Oh.
Second, but not the one.
Yeah.
Hey, what, did you happen to look at that memo?
I have to tell you, I'm really excited about the memo. When you were sick, did you send
it? Is it the one that the board discussed yesterday?
I missed the board call because I was in a revision meeting. I got on around 5:30. I was waiting. I never got my news.
Like, go ahead and table. she sees that capital abuse like dip right after people.
So that was good.
Survival increased by 2%.
Yeah. So when I see that in, I can't get internet here.
Yeah, you can.
It was in the last. So there was something from Peak.
It was in the board materials.
The board materials for yesterday's call.
I have a USB all loaded on there.
Will you?
Yeah.
Loaded on where?
Do you have an extra USB?
I don't know.
Other than this one?
No.
Okay.
We'll
I think I have
later.
A spare one.
Okay. I would love
to. Actually, you
have to email to me. You know, that makes me. I'm not going to.
Yeah. And then you'll be a. But
so that's great.
Board members, yeah.
That's great.
It's like, it's a.
No, that's good. That was great.
I said, you know, I am trying to compete myself because
yeah.
You all are too excited.
No, that's great.
But,
great.
I mean, it was exciting.
That is exciting. That is exciting.
That's
right.
Thursday. What happened?
No. No, we're going to try and do it on the 18th. I just thought, you know, in the middle of my budget season and my other division sheet stuff, so I'm like, and the PCCI is making millions of measures again. So I'm like,
I'll send it to you.
Okay, thank you. Good
to see
you. Good to see you. But I felt terrible that I missed that call. I felt terrible with that call.
Wanted to say hello.
Thank you. And you're Arbor Research Person.
I am now. I'm retired from the university. I'm a continuing on the tiny first day.
Really hard to see later. You know, I realized I was the chair of the VF and I did a lot of writing.
Right.
And
that's why we invited you to be on the chat. The recent tip for
developing.
I know we invited you.
Right, because it never happened. Because
things come and things happen.
Right, which is why. But I'm just wondering about, I had somebody who's terrific who wants to do looking like that. We have a great writing group. I haven't seen many people now. So I don't know what you're doing with the data. I'm assuming you're still collecting 100% of the data.
That's right.
So
that's
right. You can look him up, Greg Gorman.
Okay.
He's worked on a lot of projects with us. We had a great
terrific.
Writing group.
Okay.
There's a bunch of us who really did. He's really bad.
Right.
Just talked to him. He works at, he's an amazing. He trained with us at home.
Okay.
In the Navy. Alicia, and we're really good. We're really great group of people. You can go back and look for
there's
a CD.
There's a lot of information there. Yeah. It's underutilized right
I said today, I think I confused. You attorney as a new host. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Geographically,
the U.S.R.D.S. was started in Ann Arbor.
That's right.
And it moved to
Minnesota. So it's still in
Minnesota.
Allen
Collins.
So then the CPM project moved to
Minnesota. It was always in Ann Arbor. Well, I'm sorry. The CPM project. We do a lot of analysis, but
right.
We work with CPM
that's
projects.
Right. So you said the library took that CPM and
we
you
use it.
You
yes.
Did you have the CPM so you moved it to, so now it's in the all the CPM and everything else was
I'm pretty sure that USRDS has they have an actually in a sense that everybody has a different question for me. Where are your groups of people who have the
So we
I don't know if that happens. When an idea of time has come, it happens.
Nope,
not at all.
She's with that.
Okay.
Let's start gathering back to the table, please. All right, please take your seats. And while you're coming to your seat, anybody like to join us for supper tonight who hasn't told us? Speak now. Alan Krieger. Dr. Krieger. Okay, good. Anybody else? No, Alan's coming. Everybody will want to come. No. Any cancellations? Yeah. Okay, Lauren would just, before we move on, Lauren will take a minute or two just to describe the flash drive that you have all, been, with computers, have been given to, just let you know what's on there and how to use it.
For those of you with laptops, just so that you all know, everything that you have received from myself in the last couple months, all those copies are on the flash drive. So we've broken it out by topic for the measure. So there's an anemia folder, dialysis adequacy and nutrition folder, or fluid weight, mineral metabolism, infection, etc. Also, there are the additional attachments that are for the measures that are going to be at the end of the measure. So for anything related to crown web, you will find that at the end of the measure. We have some additional CMS data documentation folders. Those are in there as well. The preliminary evaluations, the Excel file and the Word file that was sent to you with all the preliminary findings are in the folder called Preliminary Evals. And then just all the supplemental material to the steering committee is in the folder entitled Steering Committee. And there's a few other additional memos that you have received from myself as well. So just as a backup, anything that you remember seeing is more than likely on this flash drive, and we can pull it up really quickly for you, for all to see.
Lauren, I'm sorry. Where did you say the actual measures, the measure list was? Which file was that?
So if we're going to start by topic. So, for instance, we're going to start with dialysis adequacy and nutrition.
Okay. So
and that folder is dialysis adequacy nutrition, pediatric, dated December 16th, 2010.
So for those of you who don't have your laptop, we can also display on the projector any particular information. If an issue comes up, we can find it. We'll, you know, so speak up if you can't find something or you need us to project something. We'll try to do that.
Yeah.
Okay, now it's time for brief introduction of measures by developers, and we don't have any particular order here, so any volunteers to go first? Jose, okay.
Good morning, it's a pleasure to be here today. My name is Jose Manoyo. I'm going to call this Vice President for Global Media Affairs for JSM Corporation. JSM Corporation is a developer for measure number 1427. A measure to report the proportion of patients who are greater than 6 milligrams per deciliter. Many of you know, cardiovascular mortality is a big cause of death and station of disease patients on dialysis. Acidic phosphorus has been identified as a significant risk factor for cardiovascular morbidity and mortality. In an analysis of more than 40,000 end station of disease patients on dialysis, disorders involving the metabolism were associated with 1.5 times the mortality risk of anemia and 3 times the mortality risk of inefficient dialysis. Disease improvement over outcomes and administration of published clinical practice guidance for renal disorders.
It recommends that physicians target a phosphorus level towards normal in end-stage disease patients on dialysis, as well as maintaining a serum calcium level within the normal range. These guidelines also reiterate that presence and severity of cardiovascular calcification strongly predicts cardiovascular morbidity and mortality in patients with chronic kidney disease. They agree that dialysis patients be considered at the highest cardiovascular risk. The dialysis community has utilized these guidelines as well as previous guidelines to guide the care of end-stage renal disease patients in the U.S. for almost a decade, and many studies have examined the impact on outcomes related to these guidelines. Considerable evidence from numerous cohorts and observational trials consistently demonstrate that serum phosphorus greater than 6 milligrams per deciliter is strongly associated with adverse cardiovascular outcomes and mortality. The Dialysis Outcomes and Practice Pattern Study is a prospective cohort study of hemodialysis practices based on the collection of observational longitudinal data from a representative random sample of patients from 12 countries, including the U.S. Those have demonstrated the correlation of serum phosphorus levels to increased mortality and cardiovascular outcomes as phosphorus level greater than 6 milligrams per deciliter. The patient characteristics in the DOPS U.S. facilities mirror the patient characteristics of the patients for which CMS is the primary payer, which is 70% of the U.S. dialysis populations. Given this, the results from DOPS can be viewed as a valid representation to discriminate performance and assess outcomes. Additionally, CMS has collected data from the ESRD Disease Management Demonstration Program from 2006 to 2009 that included a performance measure for the reporting of serum phosphorus greater than 6 milligrams per deciliter. The demonstration project tested the effectiveness of managing various quality performance parameters while containing costs under a capitated payment system. The recent technical expert panel for mineral and bone disorder agreed that serum phosphorus is an important biomarker strongly associated with adverse cardiovascular outcomes. As we review the minutes from the technical expert panel, we were disappointed that although the panel agreed on the detrimental consequences of elevated phosphorus, they could not agree on an upper limit of phosphorus, in part because the specific method to lower phosphorus might itself represent a risk to the patient, such as an increased risk for calcium binder association with detrimental calcium loading and calcification. We believe that clinical evidence demonstrates that there is a potential for high positive impact based on decreased cardiovascular morbidity and mortality when phosphorus levels are maintained under 6 milligrams per deciliter, and that the method on how that level is achieved should not detract from the benefit associated with achieving that level. clinicians are expected to balance risks to ensure optimal treatment for their patients. To summarize, the data shows that at the facility level, phosphorus of less than 6 milligrams per deciliter is associated with improvement in cardiovascular morbidity and mortality in end-stage renal disease patients. Serum phosphorus is routinely measured and has been demonstrated to be a reliable test. Additionally, the interventions to treat high serum phosphorus levels have been proven to be safe and efficacious. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Jose. We have the CMS work group and on the phone.
Hi, this is Sherry Ling. I'm a medical officer with the Quality Measurement and Health Assessment Group, and I'd like to just provide a framing for the CMS, for the measures that will be presented for which CMS is a measure steward. Just as an important start, I think we need to keep in mind that the measures that you will be hearing about today are aligned with the goals of the department and of CMS to improve the health and well-being of Medicare beneficiaries, and in this case, patients with ESRD at any age and at all ages. Our objective is to achieve better health of the population in general through better care and also at lower cost through improved care efficiency. As you will see, the measures that will be presented to you represent clinically important concepts that speak to department goals that will be aligned across all care settings eventually. And that the measures presented today are intended to move care in the direction, but we hesitate that in your review, please do not be fearful of the specter of public reporting or inclusion in the quality incentive program. It's important to keep in mind, in response to one of the comments heard earlier, that measures must go through rulemaking in order to be included in the incentive program. Now, with that said, I want to sincerely thank the steering committee for your diligent review of each proposed quality measure in the context of the goal that we share, and also thank the NQF staff for their tireless effort towards achieving this common goal. And with that said, I'd like to turn this over to Arbor Research Group.
Thanks, Sherry. I'm Bob Wolf. I'm a statistician working at Arbor Research as a contractor to CMS for supportive measures development. It is on here. Perhaps it's not active. I can use this one.
Hello?
Oh, thanks. I'm sorry about that. I'm Bob Wolf. I'm a statistician working at Arbor Research as a contractor to support CMS measure development. I've been working as a statistician in organ failure research for 35 years. I'm not a committee member, so I won't tell you that I sing in a chorus and love to ride my bicycle and cross-country ski and have two grandchildren and read and love genealogy, and consequently my TV is unplugged. Instead, I'll say that Claudia Galeras and Joe Masana and I are here to provide details if you have questions about the TEP deliberations, and also to provide information, backup information, about our substantial experience with the data flow, both through claims and through the prototype Crown Web data, which may be of interest to you. I'm going to turn this over to Joe with some more details about the substantial process we had for bringing these measures to you.
Thanks, Bob. As Dr. Wolf mentioned, my name is Joe Masana. I'm a clinical nephrologist at the University of Michigan by training and by experience. But I've worked at Keck for the last several years on a number of projects under contract with CMS, including the measures development projects in 2006 and again this past year and year and a half. We really appreciate the opportunity to be here and to listen to your deliberations and to assist you in this. I would like to recognize that we represent two organizations with a large number of dedicated staff with intellectual diversity, many of whom are listening on the phone, who put a lot of hours in to develop the numerous CMS measures under contract to CMS with our project officer, Tom Douglas. Excuse me. I'm just going to provide a brief overview of the global methodology that we used in measures development with the significant number of measures we assisted CMS in presenting. We can't talk about specifics in a couple of minutes. So these comments do not pertain to the non-CMS measures that were submitted. So I believe there are four other measures in the ESRD realm that that these comments are not pertinent to. So we started approximately a year and a half ago in identifying clinical performance guidelines, both through National Kidney Foundation's KDOKI and international guidelines as a foundation or as a basis for development of information to assist our TEPs. Subsequently, we did structured literature searches in all of the topic areas that CMS identified as being important to them prior to the convening the TEPs, and identified nearly 2,300 articles that would be potentially relevant for these topics. We screened those. All of our investigators at our two organizations screened those and identified about 650 articles that were presented to the TEPs based on topic. Subsequently, the TEPs were convened in March and then in April for the follow-up data TEP. And because of time limitations, I will just mention the chairs of the six TEPs that were convened for CMS. The Bone and Mineral TEP, the chair was Stuart Sprague from Chicago, and Francesca Tintori from Arbor Research was our facilitator. David Van Wyk chaired the Anemia Iron Committee, or TEP, with Bruce Robinson from Arbor Research as the facilitator and kind of lead reviewer of literature. The Vascular Access Infection Clinical TEP was led by Michael Alon from UAB. Ron Fassoni from Arbor Research was the facilitator. Brad Waradi, I always mispronounce his name. I apologize if he's listening in. But he was the chair for the Pediatric Hemodialysis Adequacy and Anemia TEPs, with Sylvia Ramirez being the facilitator for Arbor Research. And the Fluid TEP, which had a number of leaders in the dialysis community on the committee, was chaired by Rajiv Agrawal from University of Indiana, and Rajiv Saran was the facilitator for U of M, CAC. I had the opportunity to sit through the deliberations of the clinical TEP and then help with Dr. Wolf to facilitate the data TEP a month later. And it was an extraordinary experience watching the distillation of all of this information by these clinical experts and ESRD data technical experts to develop these numerous measures. There was some difference of opinion between clinical and data TEP in some cases, but they were generally resolved. And our measures, I think, reflect a fairly broad-based consensus by some of the leaders in the dialysis community. I'd like to finish by mentioning a couple things about data sources. All of our measures, either our proposed measures, either use Medicare claims or Crown Web as potential data sources. And we have a long experience at UMCAC and Arbor Research in calculating measures based on Medicare claims. And although, as Dr. Nally points out, there is often a lag between Medicare claims availability and the clinical events, the lag is often very short-lived. It's generally about 9 months after the close of the year. The 3 to 4 year lag that you see with some measures is related to a volitional choice to look at longer-term averages for some measures over multiple years. So generally, we're talking about 9-month lag for claims data at a minimum. And in terms of Crown Web, I think it's interesting to note. Let me just pull up. So as of September 2010, we have experience with reviewing the Crown Web data that's available. As of September 2010, approximately 80% of U.S. ESRD patients have data being reported into Crown Web, and 64% of facilities are represented in this Crown Web data. And we have had the opportunity to look at measures, previously NQF-endorsed ESRD measures, calculations, and compare those to calculations based on the 5% sample CPM data from 2006 and 2007. And there's a remarkable degree of concordance between the two. So we're quite confident that as Crown Web is rolled out, the data calculations are going to be validated. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. The other group with us today for CDC,
I think they're just going to be here tomorrow.
Oh, they're going to be here tomorrow because their measures are only under consideration tomorrow. Okay, so that would complete this. Okay, so we're ready to begin looking at our first measures, and we're going to start with the pediatric group of for adequacy and fluid. So, Karen, you're going to kick off measure 1418.
Right. I would do the introduction to the measure just to start us off and give you all a little breathing room, and then we'll go from there. So our idea is that the person who starts us off is really to help begin the discussion by summarizing the preliminary evals and specifically highlighting if there were any areas of concern or areas of differences of opinion, and then it will be open to full discussion by the entire committee and followed by a vote. So we'll vote on each measure before we move on so that it's fresh in your mind, and we'll be asking you to vote on the rating of the major criteria, and then finally whether you would recommend the measure for endorsement. Lauren will let us know at the beginning of the discussion if it's a measure that's only eligible for time limited, and we'll also mention that when you begin voting. So if we neglect to do that, please ask us. Okay. So obviously there were committee members assigned to do in-depth evaluation, and I know that most of you have become familiar with these measures, but this is measure number 1418. The title is Frequency of Adequacy Measurement for Pediatric Hemodialysis Patients. And the brief description is this is a measure about the percentage of all pediatric patients less than 18 years receiving in-center hemodialysis, irrespective of frequency of dialysis, with documented monthly adequacy measurements, SPKT over V, or its components in the calendar month. So we had several people that did preliminary evals. I'll just kind of summarize those, and then we'll have a discussion. Group that reviewed this measure thought that it did meet the importance criterion, but I will just throw out a question for you all in light of our discussion about evidence and measures, measuring topics proximal to desired outcome. This is an assessment frequency measure, and so we also have measures more directly related to the outcome, so I'll ask you to at least mull that over. It's not saying that you can't recommend this measure, but just something for you to discuss. In terms of scientific acceptability of measure properties, this measure was tested, and basically the group that reviewed it, felt that it either partially or completely met the criteria.
And just one comment about this measure in regards to testing. We're most interested in reliability and validity testing, and certainly for outcome measures, the risk adjustment model or risk adjustment method could be stratification. And so most of the measures, including this one, talk about face validity. Our criteria do allow for face validity if it's systematically assessed. We don't have enough information to know how that was assessed other than that the TEP agreed to move forward with this particular measure. Okay. Usability, basically the preliminary evaluations felt that this was a measure that would be usable. And then feasibility, again, the group felt that this measure would be feasible to measure. And there was, in terms of whether this measure, preliminary analysis, whether this measure should be recommended for endorsement, most of the preliminary evaluations were yes, but there was one no. And the comment about that was combining the measure for frequency of measurement of dialysis and that for the method of measurement of dialysis might be a better way to address both of these topics. So I'm going to stop there. Yes?
The spreadsheet on the, at least on my thumb drive, has only three reviewers.
Microphone, please.
Pardon me?
Microphone.
The thumb drive that I got provided only has three reviewers. There's two additional ones up here.
Yes. Oh, okay.
Yeah, we should leave it the 7th.
What?
So the version that you have is from last Friday on the 7th, and since then we had additional.
Right, but that's reviews. What you were going to put on.
I thought that's why we had. Thought that's why we had the thumb drive.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Well, I have three.
Okay. Sorry. Okay. Then that was the problem. With the wrong file got copied to your thumb drive. So we'll project it, and we can get those to you. Okay. Okay. Sorry about that. Okay. So. Yes.
Okay, other primary reviewers have additional comments? Do you want
to? We can.
Do we go down? Well, they comment on any part of it, I guess, at this point.
Right.
Yes?
I don't disagree with the comment by Joseph that perhaps combining the frequency and measurement into one. I rated this one independent, which I thought was how we're supposed to do it, but I don't disagree.
I want to say that I would probably, if I redid this now, I would say yes to that, and I didn't, if I were evaluating just at face value, I'm really thinking ahead to tomorrow, so.
Okay, yeah, okay, thank you. So.
Any other comments from the primary reviewers? I'll just use that term to indicate people who are assigned reviewers, maybe,
right.
would be a better term. So at this point, all of the assigned reviewers are recommending yes, then. Is that, he was the only one that he's kind of switched. Okay, so Karen, do you want to step us through the next steps?
What about the rest of the committee? What are your thoughts? Do you have any questions about the measure? Any thoughts about the measure?
Yeah. For those who reviewed it more thoroughly, can you again review for me the evidence that the frequency of measurement makes a difference to outcome?
So one of the things, if you look at the evidence section of the measure submission form, and Warren will pull that up, Most of the evidence that was presented was about the adequacy of the dose.
Right.
And then also the guideline was about the method of measurement. So
right.
That's
the reason for my question,
right.
Karen.
Okay.
Maybe it's a somewhat related question. This measure really looks at just obtaining a lab value and doesn't make any assessment of what anybody does with that lab value, which to me is, I mean, it's a part of care. It's a process of care that we could agree it might be the right thing or not, depending upon how much we believe in frequency. But I gather that the data behind a specific KT over V value in children is not that robust. It's not even that robust in adults. But that what you know, there's no requirement here for anybody to do anything with the information once it's obtained, which I find to be a problem that comes through many of the measures that I reviewed as well.
For the adults, we approved a parallel measure, I believe, and went through that process, and you know, I think the thinking was just basically that we may not know what to do with the data, but at least it should be being measured and available to the clinician, and that was sort of the justification.
And I'll just say that you're not held to that to go along that same path, and those measures will be up for review again in the next phase of this project.
And if I can ask one more question, the performance gap, I guess, here is indicated as being about 20% of children didn't have the lab test, and I just wonder whether that excludes children who were hospitalized during a given month, and whether so I guess questioning whether there is in fact a performance gap in this at all. If you expect about, it wouldn't surprise me if 20% of kids are in the hospital at any given time.
Dr. Wolf or I'm sorry. Joe, yeah. Do you have any information on that question?
You know, maybe Barb Fibers can jump because she's waving her arm and she has more direct experience in this than just about anybody.
No, I would say as a pediatrician, I think one of the things we're coming to the table with is the fact that we don't have any measures and we don't have any guidelines for documentation or measurement of what we do. And I think just saying, well, it doesn't seem important to measure this because we don't have evidence that it's important to measure this, and we have a documented gap. The concern in the pediatric community is that people are not measuring adequacy, and they're not measuring it routinely. So this is an instance where we don't have evidence, as Alan suggests, that we need to measure it monthly, but there is a parallel measure in the adult world, and we would think that at least that standard should be met in pediatrics. Now, it is possible that we'll find out that measurement of adequacy is less important than we think, but we think it is a starting point. We understand that it's low-hanging fruit, but I think as a group, we feel very strongly that people should at least be measuring it. I mean, we will get to talk about the method with which they measured and the minimal adequacy, but we think that the pediatric community has felt strongly that it should be looked at least monthly. Now, whether we harmonize that with an adult measure or we harmonize that, as Joe suggested, with measurement and a minimal level or measurement and a way that we measure it, I don't think we would argue with, but I think the suggestion that it be measured monthly, I think the to me, this is it's a minimal standard of care that we measure adequacy in pediatric patients, and I think we don't really understand that gap, and I'm not sure that we will understand that gap, because if you look at hospitalization records in USRDS, that a lot of those patients are Medicare patients. You know, you don't have information on Medicaid patients, and we're really not sure. When we look at our populations, we think about 40% are Medicare. We know that CPM and ARBOR collect 100% data, but when that's merged with morbidity and mortality data, we're not sure that we even understand the gap of where patients are and why they're not getting an adequacy measurement.
Let me see if we can get an answer to Jeffrey's question first.
Yes, I can speak to the fact that we do have the dose analysis on the claims for all patients, whether they're in the hospital or not. However, if they don't submit a bill qualification is in the hospital, then they are not in the denomination. So if they're in the hospital for the entire month, they would not be counted in the denominator as a statistic for that facility. That's potentially a limitation of the data available, but it is the fact that the data is available.
Jeffrey, does that answer your concern?
Okay.
Let's go to Alan and then back to Barb.
So again, just for the developers, as you reviewed all the data, were there any data suggesting that the frequency of once a month for adequacy measure, whatever that measure is based in any helpful frame? Is there anything in the literature that says that once a month, once every 6 months, once every 2 weeks? Any, is there anything that would guide us?
I think that's a rhetorical question.
No, it's not.
It's a real
We did not identify any specific information that validated the once a month. It is, I would say, as a practicing clinician, it's a generally accepted practice in the adult community. I won't speak as a pediatric nephrologist, others may.
Barbara.
But there is data, and I think, Alan, your point is well taken, but there's data suggests that adequacy is related to outcome, at least in, you know, in the very little bit of data that we have. There is data suggesting that, but you're right. I don't know if once a month or every 6 months is important, except that we do need to look at adequacy, measure it, and adjust it. I don't want to say it's rhetorical. I think we don't know the answer, so.
See, I guess what I'm trying to, in my mind, set the stage for all of the measures that we look at in this exercise of ours, because every clinician around the table will say that our practice is, and the best practice as we understand it, is to get measurements at some reasonably frequent intervals, and in adults we do it once a month. But the NQF, I think, has, and if you look at the criteria that we have, the responsibility of being very focused and precise about those measures that are NQF endorsed. And so I'm raising the issue, and it's not rhetorical, but you know, I'm raising a real question about when you have something that has face validity that says, yeah, we should probably be getting at some frequent measure, but nobody knows how frequently, a measure of adequacy, how are we to respond? There are thousands of measures out there, my guess is, that don't have the basis to say that there's a best practice or a best way of doing something. And how do we? How does the NQF respond to that?
Yeah, I think to follow on that, I think part of this is maybe those of us who are new to this grappling with what's the difference between a clinical practice guideline or a clinical practice recommendation, which this might be very reasonable for, versus a performance measure that will take a life of its own.
That's right.
And let me just build on Alan's point, because we fall into this trap, particularly for the patients. In the 70s, it was common clinical practice to get labs every week or at every treatment, and we've devolved away from that. And in the changing financial and regulatory environment, frequency becomes a much bigger issue than it ever had before. So I think Alan is spot on trying to set the stage for truly how we rethink all of these issues based on what data is available.
Go
ahead, Sylvia.
Yes, I was part of the TEP panel that discussed this, and one of the key points, I think in general we agree that there's no specific testing in regards to the interval for the measurement of adequacy. However, one of the considerations was the fact that the children are in a growth phase, and therefore there may be ongoing or continuous need to modify the dose of dialysis, and I think that's an important aspect for pediatric patients in general.
Okay, I would just remind the developers that they're not on the committee, and unless you're specifically asked a question, you should hold back.
Right.
Thank you. Barbara was next.
I would actually support that point that I understand that we have to look at all the measures the same way, but I'm going to step away from that for 1 second and say that we have no pediatric measures at all in ESRD, and we really do need a starting point. the adults have had an adequacy frequency measure for multiple years. I think whether this is an area where we need a time-limited endorsement, I think the reality is we have to start looking at data in pediatrics. The reason we haven't had measures before is because we haven't had evidence before. And we're not going to get evidence unless we get measures. And this is a very straightforward measure. I think we all, well, I hope we will agree there is a minimal dose of dialysis adequacy, so that would indicate we have to measure it sometime. And I think children are in a phase of growth, and it's not only growth but neurocognitive development, so adequacy may even be more critical, how often we measure it. But I definitely understand unintended consequences, measures taking on a life of their own. So with both hats on and thinking as an NQF member, thinking as a pediatrician, I still feel this is a it's critically important that we do measure adequacy in children. And I think we're going to keep going back to the fact that we don't have the same kind of evidence base. I would just remind everybody that if we combine HD and PD patients under the age of 18 in this country, we're probably looking at 1,600 patients. So it's a very, very small number. And those patients are distributed, we know, over at least 40 sites. So our largest hemo unit, we think, is about 37 patients. We can't really do the same kinds of studies. Hopefully, when we start collecting the data reliably, we will have a much better idea. And maybe we will see in 2 years that we don't need to look at it monthly.
Okay, Jerry?
This is a question about our overall process that will relate to all of our measure considerations. But when I've gone through some quality improvement training, we try to develop a family of measures for internal quality improvement. I know that we're looking at each measure separately on its own merits as separate, its own individual specifications. But in terms of eventual usability, they're going to be, in pragmatic terms, linked together to look at different parts of the care process. So in terms of this measure, this would be the frequency of measure of just obtaining the laboratory data. Another measure would probably be linked with this later. Can Karen, can you comment on how that works here?
Right. Well, I'll make a few comments. And again, as I said, there's no black and white answer here, but just a couple things. One is that we had a task force that looked at evidence last year, and they have a whole set of recommendations that we're not implementing here, but I'll just give you a little bit of their thinking about the evidence base for a measure, because we've always had this criterion about evidence. Basically, I think, as someone mentioned, once you get into using, developing, endorsing measures for performance measurement, that then might be used in public reporting, it may be used in incentive programs and other things, that you end up incentivizing developing structures or implementing these structures in your organization. And their thinking was that you should have pretty good evidence for that. The other thing is this whole idea of measuring processes that are most proximal to the desired outcome. And that, as someone already mentioned, if you measure, taking the lab test requires someone to look at the results, interpret the results, then identify the appropriate response to the results, then to deliver that response according to best practices. And so there's a whole set of things that need to happen before you actually influence the outcome. And so since our perspective is to really measure, put resources into measuring those things that are going to most drive improvement in patient health and patient outcomes, that trying to measure those things most proximal would be the way to go, and that's also where the evidence is. As we've already mentioned, the evidence that you're citing is about the adequacy of the dose. So that's the thinking, that's the preference. That's not to say that we can't endorse assessment measures. As someone else mentioned, though, there are thousands of those. If you start looking at all of the things that you should be doing in clinical practice. The other thing is when you have the process that's most proximal or the intermediate outcome or the health outcome, this may be something that you would look at for internal quality improvement in terms of, well, if you're not achieving the outcomes, maybe you're not even measuring. So, you know, there's no one that's saying that it's not important to measure this, that it's not important to measure it frequently and use this information to manage care. The question before you is whether this rises to the level of something that should be a performance measure. And, again, there's no right or wrong answer. It's for your collective discussion, but I think you're right that it affects many of the measures that you'll be looking at. And Helen, do you want to weigh in?
I think Karen really captured it. The only thing I'd add is that I think, you know, oftentimes depending on where a given area is and its level of measure development, we tend to see measures along that continuum. So if pediatric dialysis is at a much earlier stage of development, it's not surprising we're seeing some assessment measures. We're starting to see, as we move towards, for example, areas like diabetes, much more emphasis on the actual outcome as opposed to did you check the A1C. But again, I think some of that may be evolutionary in terms of where the field is. I think you need to consider that. But again, there's just nothing black and white here. I would also probably point out that I was just Googling, you know, what's the evidence for the frequency of A1C testing, for example. There's a lot of instances where there's not a huge evidence base for some of what we sort of do as clinical dictum. And I think the hope would be as you begin to get more experience around the outcomes, will that help us drive towards the better process measures as well?
Lisa?
Yeah, I have a question that's probably for staff. Many of the measures that we're going to be reviewing over the next 2 days are CMS-focused measures from CrownWeb is where they've been tested. And I guess from a private payer perspective, does that mean that these measures are only for CMS with CrownWeb as the substrate, if you will, or can we as private payers also use these measures from our own databases with access to the data? Because, you know, especially for the pediatric measures, we have the Medicaid data. So unless they're dual eligibles, you know, the data is not going to be in Medicare databases.
Once NQF endorses the measure, they can be used by any party.
Yeah, I mean, it's something to consider because, for example, for the outcome measures that are risk-adjusted, do we have access to the risk adjustment methodology, or is it something that's embedded in CrownWeb that we don't have access to?
Everything is fully open.
Okay.
So it should be. But again, I think the one consideration is for the measures that have been tested, they may have only been tested on a Medicare-only an older population, so... or in this case, probably not, since dialysis can be any age patient. But I think that would be the only consideration. Does the testing done to date on the population of the measure apply to the commercial population?
I'd just like to comment that part of the importance evaluation is the performance gap, too. And we kind of touched on that here. It would make a difference to me if there's a big gap. Only half the patients are ever getting their... if that was the case, say only half the patients were ever getting their adequacy measured, I would feel it's important that they start measuring it. Do we have information on the gap here? That was 20%. Wasn't that what you were? It was stated.
It was 20%.
And we established it's probably not because of hospitalizations, right? So is that a realistic number? And to me, that's quite worrisome.
I think that there, and I was using the example of the Medicaid, Medicare hospitalization in terms of impact of adequacy, and we're linking it to morbidity and mortality when many of our patients aren't, they're in the CPM or the CrownWeb system, but they may not, their morbidity and mortality, because if they're hospitalized, there's not Medicare claim, we sometimes have a harder time establishing what the long-term outcome is of an intermediate outcome. So we can record intermediate outcomes like adequacy. But looking at the CPM data years back when I worked on that project, and I guess we're hearing there has been a persistent, and I would be interested in what Arbor has seen recently, but we did
demonstrate over time a continued gap in measurement. My question, and not getting back to the gap question, is, and this is a procedural question, if we don't approve a frequency measure, and I'm just, again, new to this myself, we don't approve a frequency measure, but we approve a minimal level of adequacy, then we've approved something that doesn't have to be measured at any frequency. How do we have to reconcile that? That's a question. I'm just thinking, how do we do that then?
I think that's a good question. And we're not going to be doing measure development here, but there are ways to build that into a measure so that you kind of get a negative if there's no measurement rather than being excluded for missing information. So there are ways to work that into measures. It's not so, but we don't have that measure exactly. So, but just for future, I mean, that's how some people have addressed it. It's not necessarily the only way.
I don't think Alan was really objecting to this measure so much as trying to set a standard for the discussion, which I think is really important because the more important the measures are, the more bearing they have on, the more evidence-based they are, and the more bearing they have on improving care, the more credible they'll all be. But when it comes to pediatric measures, it's a little bit different. And it's a vulnerable population, and if there's not a lot of pediatric evidence, I think we're more obligated to identify if there's data to suggest that it's not equally applicable to the pediatric population rather than that there is pediatric data. So I think the point you're making is extremely important. But the pediatric population is really different, I think, and so we probably need to err more on the side of making measurements than we would, say, in an adult population where we might just be adding to the burden of measurement without improvement.
So it's an interesting question methodologically here because we're being asked to look at these measures independent of others with a later harmonization plan. I personally have a problem looking at this single measure standing alone as a frequency measure that is not harmonized and is not brought together with other potential measures. So, you know, I'd want to give, I mean, to be honest with you, this is the one I'd want to give sort of provisional yes to with the presumption that we can make it a better measure with harmonization.
So that's an excellent point. So let me clarify, because we've gone back and forth of how to look at related and competing measures. And, our most recent best guess is that we should look at individual measures first and then look at related and competing measures. So having said that, all of the recommendations that you make today before we address that will be provisional, meaning that once we do the comparison, you can change that particular recommendation. So the point right now is, does this measure meet the criteria when you look at it alone? Tomorrow, when we look at related and competing measures, we can revisit that recommendation. But the reason we're doing that is we don't really want to spend your time comparing measure specifications if the measure is going to fail on some other criterion. So it's kind of, it's probably a chicken and egg kind of thing, and, maybe some people would prefer to start one way than the other, but we were just trying to think of in terms of the amount of materials that we want to make sure measures should go forward before we start spending time comparing them to other measures. And we'll certainly learn from your experience again and see if there's other things we should be considering.
Any other comments right now? Okay, so are you ready to start going through the...
Okay.
So we're going to vote on
important straight up or down, or we're going to do each of the, they're going to do the three sub-criteria?
No, we won't do the sub-criteria. So, Tanae, you want to put up the first question. So this is the measure, and the first question is just on the major criterion of importance to measure and report. If you say yes, you press 1 and then send. If you say no, you press 2 and then send. And we will go ahead and start the timer. It's wrong. Yeah. Okay, we'll give Tanae a second. We wanted to give you 60 seconds. This program defaults to 10 seconds, and we think that's not enough time. So what we will be doing, and I'll just kind of tell you again what we're going to be doing, is we'll put up each of the major criterions. So importance to measure and report is a yes, no. The other three, scientific acceptability, usability, and feasibility, is that completely, partially, minimally, or not at all. And then we'll end with, would you recommend the measure for endorsement? And we'll keep it in mind that that's with the caveat that if there are related and competing measures, we will be looking at that tomorrow. And, you know, that may change things once you look at it in that light. Pardon me? Oh, just the whole major criterion. Not, yes. Right. You should be thinking about the sub-criteria as you vote on that, but we're just going to have you vote on the major criterion. Yes. Yes.
One of the answer buttons, and the green light comes on, but we hesitate to push send, and the green light goes off. Can we still push send?
Yes, yes.
I may have voted twice then.
It hasn't registered yet. Okay, we're going to try this again. We had a mix-up with the program, so we're starting over. So we're on that same measure. We're on importance to measure and report.
Wait for the green.
Okay. Does it only record it when the clock is running?
Yes.
When it's green.
Okay.
Light.
Okay.
Right.
All right. So
it didn't lift on
the Tanae, go ahead. Okay. There's your clock.
You might be like
that. That's what I was asking. The light goes off. Can you get to push it again?
Okay. I mean, so the green light goes on when you press the button.
But after about 5 seconds, it goes off. So if you haven't
extended it, it doesn't help.
Question. Right. Yeah. I don't know.
So you got to press it and send it. We're having a harder time figuring out how to vote.
We'll give you up to a minute, but if everyone gets their votes in, then we can stop it, and we will go to tally, okay?
Tell me the total number of voters?
Yes.
Okay. Good.
And this is fairly new for us, so thank you for being guinea pigs. We've used this once before, but it'll be so much easier. We would literally walk around just counting hands for an hour a meeting, so this should be a little easier.
Next criterion, scientific acceptability. So Tanae, you'll choose your response. Okay, go ahead. Okay. Okay, and we'll go on to the next one, usability. And same thing, go. Right. And then feasibility. And then finally, your vote on recommending that it move forward for consideration for endorsement, and with the caveat that we will look at this with related and competing measures. Just wait until the end. And everyone thinks they have their vote in? Okay.
Vote early and often.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right. So, this one, 17 yes and 3 no. Okay. So now we've got one measure under our belt. And
and just in case you guys are nervous, it routinely just having sat through probably hundreds of these in the last 4 years, the first measure always takes an hour and a half, so you guys are ahead of schedule. So it'll speed up significantly now, especially if the technology cooperates. So
congratulations, committee. Okay, let's If we're able to stay on schedule, we'll have three more done in the next 35 minutes or so. Barbara, you are the chosen person for 1421 and 1423. So let's go to 1421, method of adequate C measures for pediatric chemo patients.
Okay. So I'm going to try and do this as briefly and as wonderfully as Karen did it. So this measure is entitled Method of Adequacy Measurement for Pediatric HD. The description is the percent of pediatric in-center hemodialysis patients for whom the delivered dose of adequacy was measured by single pool KT over V is calculated using urea kinetic method or the DeGuertis during the reporting period. The numerator statement is the number of patients in the denominator with monthly adequacy measures using this methodology, and the denominator is number of pediatric patients less than 18 on in-center hemodialysis, irrespective of frequency of dialysis. In looking at the categories that were commented on, there were five evaluators of this measure that were in the program, and the first one was the criteria for importance in measure of report. And of the reviewers, five said yes.
for that category. There were no substantive comments. The second category was if scientific acceptability criteria were met. Two people felt it was partial criteria met, and three felt that this measure completely met the acceptability criteria. To what extent was the criteria of usability met? Four felt that it was completely met. One felt that it was partially met. To what extent was the criteria of feasibility met? Four felt it was completely met, and one felt it was partially met. The overall recommendation of this measure was, of the five evaluators, was to approve it in four of the evaluators felt to approve it, and one felt not to. I looked at all the comments during, you know, throughout all the subcategories, and there really wasn't anything substantive about why we wouldn't accept this measure. The reviewer who felt that we shouldn't, I think, felt in looking through the comments that it should be combined and harmonized with another measure, and therefore it would be more valuable if it was a linked measure rather than a standalone measure to look at the method of adequacy measurement, that perhaps it should have been linked with the frequency of adequacy measurement. So I couldn't find any substantive comments. I think this is an important, well, I'm going to leave it. That's my presentation of the method. Karen.
Okay, thank you. Other assigned reviewers now?
I just want to comment on the DeGertis methodology on being on, it is related to frequency as opposed to what's stated. So is that going to vary in pediatric patients, or I'm not quite.
Pete, maybe I can
clarify.
I mean, if we're not using standard KTV, if you're using just the standard DeGertis, the only way that you can compare is for everyone to be at the same frequency. So that if you're looking at everyone on three times a week, yes, it would make sense to look at KTV of a sampling of. But if you're looking, as you wrote here, independent of frequency, then you cannot compare a patient on five times a week to a patient on three times a week without using standard KTV.
Right, and again, there's somewhere in here that I saw the frequency varies a great deal as opposed to the adult populations.
I would comment, and I think I might have actually put that comment in there, or might have put it in the next one with minimal, when we look at minimal levels of KTV, that the pattern in pediatrics is somewhat different than in adults. It can be either three or four times a week, and that is not uncommon, as opposed to nightly or daily dialysis. This is just a pattern for our regular 3 to 4 hour treatment patients. The younger patients seem to benefit from having more frequent dialysis, and it doesn't fit into any category that generally is a pattern seen in internal medicine. So I understand the concern that if we measure a KT over V and we're looking at it in a patient who gets it four times a week versus three times a week, it will be lower in a patient that's four times a week. But that the pediatric community spoke about this at great length. I was not on the CTEP, but the thought was that many of the patients that are receiving dialysis four times a week are very young infants and children, and they're going to meet a minimal KT over V target, and that was how, reading through these comments, how that measure was constructed, but I understand the concerns.
And if I may, again, the issue isn't that it isn't important to do, but KTV is not additive. You can't simply add up the KTV of each dialysis session to come up with a dose. So if the measure is intended to measure a dose of dialysis and this varying frequency of those dialyses, I would submit you really cannot use KTV. You need to use standard KTV.
So you're talking about a more of a weekly number. And I think that, and Alan, I think that may be more important in the next measurement when we talk about minimum levels, but I think you're correct. It does impact this measure as well in the methodology, which suggests if you're going to use or take into account anybody that has more than three times a week, we should not be looking at single-pool KTB.
Do we have any data from the developer as far as the frequency? How common is more than three times a week or four times a week or more in the pediatric population?
Some of that information is covered in the best measure, which does have to do with the actual threshold value that should be achieved. And I believe that addresses some of the concerns that Alan is raising, that the criterion for achieving 1.2 is specified in terms of the frequency. Right now, the measure, if I understand it, that's being considered is the method of measurement. And the method of measurement that did consider whether the standardized KT over B would be appropriate.
Standardized,
thank you. And they also considered the surface area normalized. And both of them were considered as being worthy and important to consider in the future, but there wasn't adequate data yet to consider them. For the frequency, what we do know is that about 20% of patients don't have any KT over B measured, or it's not measured by KT over B. So this has the same evidence base as the first measure, where it's the frequency and the method are missing in about 20% of the patients. There's another documentation you have on your thumb drive, and the specifications where it points out in this particular facility, they have, which is well known, and they had about 40% of the patients with pediatric patients without measures. And in that sub-study, there were a large number of facilities that just didn't measure it at all. Not a large number, but a not insignificant number that just didn't measure it at all.
Joseph?
I'm not a pediatric nephrologist, but I wonder if there are kind of practice variations whereby those that dialyze, say, four times a week use a Degerdis formulation versus maybe others with different frequencies use a UKM, or do those associate in terms of what types of measurements are used as opposed to the frequency of dialysis per week? Since there are relatively small numbers of pediatric patients and practices, perhaps different practices could have patterns whereby you dialyze a certain frequency and say you dialyze four times a week and have selected the Degerdis as your way to follow people, as other people might be more likely to dialyze three times a week and use UKM. So are there trackings whereby frequency and methodology of measurement either associate or not?
I don't know the answer to that question. It's a good question. I don't know the answer.
I think that's a very good question. I think that people are not saying, if I understand your question correctly, people are not saying I'm dialyzing four times a week, I'm going to use this methodology, versus I'm dialyzing three times a week, I'm going to use this methodology for calculating KT over V. I think people are dialyzing and using a methodology for calculating KT over V. So
because it has potential also for the next measure we'll talk about relating to what target you set.
That's right. So again, they're not independent of each other. That is, John Degerdis and his method, for example, is what's used to calculate the standard KTV over a week. So we're not talking about a difference, but rather the conceptual issue of the relationship of frequency to dose. And that's why I would strongly recommend that if we're talking about a method for dose, that if frequency is somehow in that method, and it is in this one, that it not be just the Degerdis, but either the Degerdis or any other method that is that has a way of standardizing for the time period.
A question, it says in the documents here that only 76% of patients had delivered KT over B calculated using either one of these two methods. What was used in the other quarter? And is there evidence, what is the evidence that that's an inferior method of determining KT over V if there, or if it doesn't say it wasn't measured, it was just, it says a different measure was utilized.
I suspect that it was not measured. Is that?
Or UR.
Right, or UR, which.
Okay, other comments?
So is this a time when, if this group felt that that was a concern, that we could modify the measure? Or is that...
We can't modify it. We can ask the developers to consider it. While we're trying not to harmonize or think of multiple measures, that in my mind it seems difficult to justify this, especially if we might consider the next one, which does... take frequency into account, and why do we care, and why should we endorse a measure that probably isn't the right calculation at this, you know, in the present state of knowledge? My synthesis of it at this point.
So it is within your purview to recommend a measure on the condition that, in this case, the method be specified as you've been talking about. That would be something that we would then go back to the measure developer for their response, and we would bring their response back to you to determine whether it met your condition or if they submit a rationale of why they can't, and you could accept their rationale, or you could say, okay, we're not going to move forward with the measure then. So it is something that you can do, especially we want those kinds of things to be well-grounded in evidence and guidelines and, you know, have a good basis in our criteria for making the recommendation.
And any testing they've done, though, might not be applicable anymore if they weren't testing that metric.
So then there's the consideration, did that in any way negate some of the testing. So, you know, I can't answer that offhand, but I guess I would say that we would want to be most closely aligned with the evidence, and we could deal with the testing issues, you know, rather than saying, and that's why we have importance, which includes evidence as kind of the top of the hierarchy. So I think we can probably deal with that. But so I think, you know, really based on your clinical expertise and the evidence that you know for these, how this testing should be done, that's what should guide you.
If I can just return to my earlier question, and I just don't know the answer to this, whether URR has been shown to be, as you know, inferior in any way in children as a assessment of dialysis adequacy. And then second, since, and it probably relates to several of these measures, pediatric patients encompasses little tiny babies and elementary school kids and teenagers, and we're applying the same measures to all of them. I think we should just think about whether that's appropriate or inappropriate for some portions of that patient population.
I think that the limited evidence that we have is KT over V, and it's not URR. I can't think of a good study where we've looked at URR and even any kind of morbidity and mortality, so I don't think the pediatric community would think that that was actually a good measure. I want to clarify, because I think this will come up again, that the concern, I believe, is that we're letting the denominator include patients that are having dialysis at different frequencies, and we're trying to use a single pool KT over V. We're allowing a single pool KT over V rather than a standard KT over V. And the thought that I heard from Arbor is that the method, the developing group, or the CTEP that developed this measure, was concerned that we have very limited experience using a standard.
Yeah. There's a way around that, and that's to define the method of measuring a single dialysis's adequacy. If you call it that as the method, and then later aggregate it according to frequency, then you've solved your problem.
So that was.
So you're recommending renaming it to a different, giving it a different.
Instead of, I would suggest instead of calling it with, you know, saying anything about frequency at all in this measure, to define this as a method of measuring pediatric hemodialysis adequacy for a single dialysis session.
So to clarify, I'm trying to, what Alan is saying is that we just talked about the last measure that we have to measure that dialysis adequacy. And in this measure, we're saying we have to measure it using a certain methodology. And that methodology is difficult. So the measure would then become that it's not that you had to just measure it, but you'd have to measure it each single treatment using a standardized methodology.
I'm just saying you're defining a methodology for measuring a treatment's adequacy. And so you don't have to deal with the frequency piece at all. When you do indeed do the frequency piece, you know you'll have to use standard KPV, but you can eliminate that problem by just calling this method to assess a dialysis session's adequacy.
But then is that important, especially in view of other metrics coming up?
Well, I think it is additive to the fact that it has to be measured. I think it's going to say, if I understand what the suggestion would be to the developers, would be that you have to state, irregardless of frequency, there would be a standardized methodology for calculating adequacy. The first one is that you calculate adequacy. So I think this would give us the same, Alan's suggestion seems to give us the same thing that this measure gives us, but takes the frequency question, and which you know, I know we're not supposed to go forward, which was an issue with the next measure in this measure set. So I guess I don't know procedurally where the group.
Well, if the committee agreed with Alan's suggestion, then we would submit that back to the developer rather than approve the method the metric as it is, right?
Yeah, I would support Alan because after all this is going to deal with harmonization down the road. And this is a direction that adult adequacy is moving because of more frequent dialysis and home dialysis. So rather than have to go through this painful process, I would support Alan's suggestion.
So,
okay, Barbara.
So would an alternative suggestion to the committee then be, and just trying to think of alternative suggestions, that the denominator would exclude any patients other than receiving three times a week if you're going to use...
That's not what I'm suggesting.
No, I understand. I'm just saying, is that an alternative?
The other alternative is to leave it as is, but specify a common frequency, like three times a week. Those are in my mind, those are the two scientifically valid alternatives.
As mentioned before, this is a composite type score. When you evaluate an internal QI, your assessment of each patient, this comes into play with the other factors, and Alan mentioned that before, as did Barb. So I think you have to look at this in the big picture. And it adds to our understanding, although somewhat immature at this point in time, because we don't have the data. That's what we need to accumulate.
Okay, other comments? Are we ready to start voting on this one?
Well, I guess before we go to voting, we'll do a hand vote on this to see if, Alan, do you want to make a motion of state what you're suggesting, and then we'll have the committee weigh in on that and then decide how we proceed with the rest of the voting on this.
Yeah, well, I would move that the measure be entitled Method of Adequacy Measurement in a Single Dialysis Session for Pediatric Hemodialysis Patients, and that the discussion of the denominator exclude frequency.
Okay. So the denominator then would just be pediatric hemodialysis patients.
as a point of clarification, would this then not be eligible for voting? We would send it back.
Well, we could vote on it with that condition. So I think this is what we'll do. We'll first vote on whether you agree with that condition. And if you do, then we'll proceed with the voting, and your vote would be, does that make sense?
Okay. Can we throw back to Arbor just one time? Do you, and I think this might have been asked, and I might have missed it, and I think Jeffrey might have asked this. Do we know how many patients are getting four times versus three times a week hemodialysis?
5%.
So
that's on page 37.
Okay.
The recommendations report is 5.6%. And the text conclusion was that I'll just quote it here. Given that this is not a disease, and this is having to do with the next measure for the minimum criterion. Given that this is not an insignificant proportion, these patients should be included in this measure. That's for the minimum threshold. The definition of the measure having to do with method of hemodialysis has a denominator which is irrespective of frequency. And Alan, I'm not sure why you're saying it should be irrespective of frequency, because that's what it is. Are you proposing
that? I mean, I apologize, I'm not as familiar with that. In the discussion that I saw and heard, there was a discussion of frequency, three or more times, that's all. If the definition is clearly has nothing about frequency, then I would... Okay.
It's irrespective of frequency.
So now we're looking at just a matter of retitling it so that it's clear. This is just single session, KT over V, that if you're going to measure it, you should use one of these two metrics, one of these two methods. Is that so? It's not a matter of changing anything else about the...
I mean, again, I apologize for making a tempest in a teapot here, but if indeed this is independent of frequency, then I think it can stand as it's proposed. The trouble has to do with the frequency of measurement. So if this is simply methodology and it has and there's nothing to do with frequency, that...
Do you want to clarify something we'd asked before?
Just reiterate the definition for 1421, the method of adequacy measurement. The numerator states, if I'm reading it correctly, that it's the number of patients in the denominator for whom the delivered hemodialysis dose was calculated using urea kinetics measurement or DeGerdes 2 during the reporting period and for whom the frequency of hemodialysis per week is specified. So it asks for information about frequency.
Right.
The denominator says irrespective of frequency of dialysis. So I think that it is asking for information that would allow for more meaningful calculations based on frequency.
So to make the numerator, you have to have both the it was done by a certain method and the frequency of treatments that given a week or some such has to also be in there, or they're not included in the numerator.
So it does assure that we get the information that Alan is concerned about, and it's necessary for the next measure also to be able to define the next measure, which is based upon...
Right, but if this measure is not approved, the next measure still stands on its own, right? Or do you need the data from this metric to do the next metric? You can do the next metric without this.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, as a non-primary reviewer, I am having trouble seeing the importance of doing this, particularly if we're going to look at, you know, I think it may add more confusion than help to the whole situation. This is my comment.
One other question, and this applies to a lot of the measures, that they specify these are for in-center hemodialysis, they don't explicitly say excluding home hemodialysis, but I think it's a question that you all need to consider. So am I correct that this would exclude any home hemodialysis patients?
Yes, the denominator is among patients less than 18 years old receiving in-center hemodialysis. Okay.
And I know many of the measures do that, so I just want to throw that out to the committee also to be thinking about whether that's
necessary.
And a question about that. So if you have kids in acute dialysis centers in a hospital, that would exclude them too, because they would not be considered in-center. And that's not, and I may be wrong, but at least in the population I know, it's not an insignificant number.
Theoretically, there are chronic patients dialyzed in acute units, but they wouldn't have a 27-28 form,
so
that
they wouldn't the data.
Be considered ESRD, so they wouldn't be in the pool. So theoretically, you would not be dealing with patients that were, although you could be dealing with patients that were sick and acutely dialyzed and had chronic ESRD that were in the hospital for more than a month, could be captured in this measure, I think.
That's correct. The definitions here were driven to a large extent by medical criteria that Joseph Allen was concerned with, ensuring that we had the right information to come up with the right measure, but also the practical data flow that truly is available. And the CPET is trying to come up with measures which are useful for a large number of patients for whom we have data. And our ability to bring in other patients who might be important is certainly important, but
yeah,
we're
get
doing
the data.
Available
yeah.
right now.
Okay. And data on home hemodialysis patients, which I guess is still a very small fraction of pediatric hemodialysis patients, right? But that's not collected under this metric.
It has not been yet.
But I guess that's my question. Just because you don't currently have the data, my question is there some clinical reason that those patients should not be included in the measure? If you don't have the data, they're not going to be included in the performance score, but do we need to limit the measure to exclude them when maybe a year down the line? So it's just a question. Is it strictly a matter of there's a few numbers and the data aren't available, or is it driven by the clinical?
Or in other words, maybe what you're saying is, if we pass this metric, are we saying you don't need to measure it in home hemodialysis patients? And I think the answer is, of course, we think it should be measured in home hemodialysis patients too. But that would require, again, another rewrite of the statement.
But it is excluded, right? It is an exclusion. I mean, it says exclusions are patients on home hemo, patients not in the facility for the entire calendar month.
What's the justification for excluding patients on home hemodialysis?
But one question, once it's adopted, any home program can still use the measure. So we're not precluding them from measuring the data at some point, but it's not a requirement at this point.
Right, but because you're saying they're excluded, it could lead people to believe that maybe it's not relevant to...
Okay. I think are we ready? Any more comments? I think we're ready to start voting on this metric.
Okay. So we're going to vote on the metric as it is, In the future, when there's a question about the numerator and denominator, we can display it so that we can make sure we're all on the same page, okay? All right. So we're on this measure as it's stated. And the first question is about importance to measure and report. And go ahead and... Question then? Scientific acceptability of measure properties. Next question, usability.
Karen pointed out to me that people on the phone aren't able to hear the see the results of the voting and might like to know. And we were going to announce, but when we saw it was on the screen, we decided not to. So from now on, why don't you use one of us will go ahead and...
Okay, so the results were that 6 completely, 11 partially, 2 minimally, and 1 not at all. Feasibility. Okay, so for feasibility, we have 7 completely, 11 partially, 2 minimally, and that's all.
Okay, and then finally, recommend for endorsement.
You hear the ooze. We have 11 for yes and 9 no's.
Is that enough of a consensus to...
Well, generally what we would do is when we put out the draft report, we will note that the steering committee was more divided on their recommendation for this particular measure. We'll ask for comments, and it's something that you could, depending on the comments, revisit at that point. But that's generally what we would do. Time check. It's...
12:10, we're at
our
lunch break time. I don't know if it's an issue for serving it while it's hot.
Okay, so lunch is out there, so we have 2 options. We can break for lunch, we'll take a half hour, and then come back and resume this. We're a little bit behind schedule, but I think, you know, as we get into a groove here, we'll do okay. Or we can try to push through the 2 more measures. What do you guys think?
And you don't want to eat and work at the same time. That's not
no. Some people will be leaving. That we could work through lunch. Okay. So we could go ahead and get lunch and come back and resume in about 15 minutes. Do you want to try that?
Okay. So unless there's objections, let's break. Get your food. Let's try to resume at about 12:30. And we'll see how that works out. Okay? Thank you. Because that would be a plus button. Plus light works. Yeah.
So that way.
Yeah. Bring one up here. Go with.